creepy fantasies had diminished in frequency. Then he spent the latter half of his 37th year feeling closer to confidence than he ever had before. Something had shifted. Something had cemented. Somewhere his name had been tapped into stone. He would always have work. He could rest for a bit if he wanted to. It was September, and he was coming back from a shoot and about to embark upon a European publicity tour. He had one day in the city, just one, and Jude told him he'd take him anywhere he wanted. They'd see each other, they'd have lunch, and then he'd get back into the car and go straight to the airport for the flight to London. It had been so long since he had been in New York, and he really wanted to go somewhere cheap and downtown and homey, like the Vietnamese noodle place they had gone to when they were in their 20s, but he instead picked a French restaurant known for its seafood in Midtown so Jude wouldn't have to travel far. The restaurant was filled with businessmen, the kinds of people who telegraphed their wealth and power with the cut of their suits and the subtlety of their watches. You had to be wealthy and powerful yourself in order to understand what was being communicated. To everyone else, they were men in gray suits, indistinguishable from one another. The hostess brought him to Jude, who was there already, waiting, and when Jude stood, he reached over and hugged him very close, which he knew Jude didn't like, but which he had recently decided he would start doing anyway. They stood there, holding each other, surrounded on either side by gray-suited men, until he released Jude, and they sat. "Did I embarrass you enough?" he asked him, and Jude smiled and shook his head. There were so many things to discuss in so little time that Jude had actually written an agenda on the back of a receipt, which he had laughed at when he had seen it, but which they ended up following fairly closely. Between Topic 5, Malcolm's wedding, what were they going to say in their toasts, and Topic 6, the progression of the Green Street apartment, which was being gutted, he had gotten up to go to the bathroom, and as he walked back to the table, he had the unsettling feeling that he was being watched. He was, of course, used to being appraised and inspected, but there was something different about the quality of this attention, its intensity and hush. And for the first time in a long time, he was self-conscious, aware of the fact that he was wearing jeans and not a suit, and that he clearly didn't belong. He became aware, in fact, that everyone was wearing a suit, and he was the only one not. "I think I'm wearing the wrong thing," he said quietly to Jude as he sat back down. "Everyone's staring." "They're not staring at you because of what you're wearing," Jude said. "They're staring at you because you're famous." He shook his head. "To you and literally dozens of other people, maybe." "No, Willem," Jude had said. "You are." He smiled at him. "Why do you think they didn't make you wear a jacket? They don't let just anyone waltz in here who's not corporate mufti. And why do you think they keep bringing over all these appetizers? It's not because of me, I guarantee you." Now he laughed. "Why did you choose this place anyway? I thought you were going to pick somewhere downtown." He groaned. "I heard the crudo was good." "And what do you mean? Is there a dress code here?" Jude smiled again and was about to answer when one of the discreet, gray-suited men came over to them and, vividly embarrassed, apologized for interrupting them. "I just wanted to say that I loved the Sycamore Court," he said. "I'm a big fan." Willem thanked him, and the man, who was older, in his 50s, was about to say something else when he saw Jude and blinked, clearly recognizing him, and stared at him for a bit, obviously recategorizing Jude in his head, refiling what he knew about him. He opened his mouth and shut it, and then apologized again as he left, Jude smiling serenely at him the entire time. "Well, well," said Jude, after the man had hurried away. "That was the head of the litigation department of one of the biggest firms in the city, and apparently an admirer of yours." He grinned at Willem. "Now are you convinced you're famous?" "If the benchmark for fame is being recognized by 20-something female RISD graduates and aging closet cases, then yes," he said, and the two of them started snickering childishly until they were both able to compose themselves again. Jude looked at him. Only you could be on magazine covers and not think you're famous, he said, fondly. But Willem wasn't anywhere real when those magazine covers came out. He was on set. On set, everyone acted like they were famous. It's different, he told Jude. I can't explain it. But later, in the car to the airport, he realized what the difference was. Yes, he was used to being looked at, but he was only really used to being looked at by certain kinds of people in certain kinds of rooms. People who wanted to sleep with him, or who wanted to talk to him because it might help their own careers, or people for whom the simple fact that he was recognizable was enough to trigger something hungry and frantic in them, to crave being in his presence. He wasn't, however, accustomed to being looked at by people who had other things to do, who had bigger and more important matters to worry about than an actor in New York. Actors in New York, they were everywhere. The only time men with power ever looked at him was at premieres, when he was being presented to the studio head and they were shaking his hand and making small talk, even as he could see them examining him, calculating how well he'd tested and how much they'd paid for him and how much the film would have to earn in order for them to look at him more closely. Perversely, though, as this began happening more and more, he would enter a room, a restaurant, a building, and would feel, just for a second, a slight collective pause. He also began realizing that he could turn his own visibility on and off. If he walked into a restaurant expecting to be recognized, he always was. And if he walked in expecting not to be, he rarely was. He was never able to determine what exactly, beyond his simply willing it, made the difference. But it worked. It was why, 6 years after that lunch, he was able to walk through much of Soho in plain sight, more or less, after he moved in with Jude. He had been at Green Street since Jude got home from his suicide attempt, and as the months passed, he found that he was migrating more and more of his things, first his clothes, then his laptop, then his boxes of books and his favorite woolen blanket that he liked to wrap about himself and shuffle around in as he made his morning coffee. His life was so itinerant that there really wasn't much else he needed or owned, to his old bedroom. A year later, he was living there still. He'd woken late one morning and made himself some coffee. He'd had to bring his coffee maker as well because Jude didn't have one, and had meandered sleepily about the apartment, noticing as if for the first time that somehow his books were now on Jude's shelves and the pieces of art he'd brought over were hanging on Jude's walls. When had this happened? He couldn't quite remember, but it felt right. It felt right that he should be back here. Even Mr. Irvine agreed. Willem had seen him at Malcolm's house the previous spring for Malcolm's birthday, and Mr. Irvine had said, "I hear you've moved back in with Jude." And he said he had, preparing himself for a lecture on their eternal adolescence. He was going to be 44, after all. Jude was nearly 42. "But you're a good friend, Willem," Mr. Irvine had said. "I'm glad you boys are taking care of each other." He had been deeply rattled by Jude's attempt. They all had, of course, but Mr. Irvine had always liked Jude the best of all of them, and they all knew it. "Well, thanks, Mr. Irvine," he'd said, surprised. "I'm glad, too." In the first raw weeks after Jude had gotten out of the hospital, Willem used to go into his room at odd hours to give himself confirmation that Jude was there and alive. Back then, Jude slept constantly, and he would sometimes sit on the end of his bed, staring at him and feeling a sort of horrible wonder that he was still with them at all. He would think, if Richard had found him just 20 minutes later, Jude would have been dead. About a month after Jude had been released, Willem had been at the drugstore and had seen a box cutter hanging on the rack. Such a medieval, cruel instrument, it seemed, and it almost burst into tears. Andy had told him that the emergency room surgeon had said Jude's had been the deepest, most decisive self-inflicted incisions he had ever seen in his career. He had always known that Jude was troubled, but he was awestruck almost by how little he knew him, by the depths of his determination to harm himself. He felt that he had in some ways learned more about Jude in the past year than he had in the past 26, and each new thing he learned was awful. Jude's stories were the kinds of stories that he was unequipped to answer, because so many of them were unanswerable. The story of the scar on the back of his hand, that had been the one that had begun it, had been so terrible that Willem had stayed up that night, unable to sleep, and had seriously contemplated calling Harold, just to be able to have someone else share the story with him, to be speechless alongside him. The next day he couldn't stop himself from staring at Jude's hand, and Jude had finally drawn his sleeve over it. "You're making me self-conscious," he said. "I'm sorry," he'd said. Jude had sighed. "Willem, I'm not going to tell you these stories if you're going to react like this," he said, finally. "It's okay. It really is. It was a long time ago. I never think about it." He paused. "I don't want you to look at me differently if I tell you these things." He'd taken a deep breath. "No," he said. "You're right. You're right." And so now, when he listened to these stories of Jude's, he was careful not to say anything. To make small, non-judgmental noises, as if all his friends had been whipped with a belt soaked in vinegar until they had passed out, or been made to eat their own vomit off the floor, as if those were normal rites of childhood. But despite these stories, he still knew nothing. He still didn't know who Brother Luke was. He still didn't know anything except isolated stories about the monastery or the home. He still didn't know how Jude had made it to Philadelphia or what had happened to him there. And he still didn't know the story about the injury. But if Jude was beginning with the easier stories, he now knew enough to know that those stories, if he ever heard them, would be horrific. He almost didn't want to know. The stories had been part of a compromise when Jude had made it clear that he wouldn't go to Dr. Lohmann. Andy had been stopping by most Friday nights, and he came over one evening shortly after Jude had returned to Rosen Pritchard. As Andy examined Jude in his bedroom, Willem made everyone drinks, which they had on the sofa, the lights low and the sky outside grainy with snow. "Sam Lohmann says you haven't called him," Andy said. "Jude, this is bullshit. You've got to call him. This was part of the deal." "Andy, I've told you," Jude said. "I'm not going." Willem was pleased then to hear that Jude's stubbornness had returned, even though he disagreed with him. 2 months ago, when they had been in Morocco, he had looked up from his plate at dinner to see Jude staring at the dishes of mezze before him, unable to serve himself any of them. "Jude?" he'd asked, and Jude had looked at him, his face fearful. "I don't know how to begin," he'd said, quietly, and so Willem had reached over and spooned a little from each dish onto Jude's plate and told him to start with the scoop of stewed eggplant at the top and eat his way clockwise through the rest of it. "You have to do something," Andy said. He could tell Andy was trying to remain calm and failing, and that, too, he found heartening, a sign of a certain return to normalcy.
"Willem thinks so, too, right, Willem? You can't just keep going on like this. You've had a major trauma in your life. You have to start discussing things with someone."
"Fine," said Jude, looking tired. "I'll tell Willem."
"Willem's not a healthcare professional," said Andy. "He's an actor."
And at that, Jude had looked at him, and the two of them had started laughing, so hard that they had to put their drinks down. And Andy had finally stood and said that they were both so immature he didn't know why he bothered, and had left, Jude trying to call after him.
"Andy, we're sorry. Don't leave,"
but laughing too hard to be intelligible. It was the first time in months, the first time since even before the attempt, that he had heard Jude laugh. Later, when they had recovered, Jude had said,
"I thought I might, you know, well, start telling you things sometimes. But do you mind? Is it going to be a burden?"
And he had said of course it wouldn't be, that he wanted to know. He had always wanted to know, but he didn't say this. He knew it would sound like criticism. But as much as he was able to convince himself that Jude had returned to himself, he was also able to recognize that he had been changed. Some of the changes were, he thought, good ones. The talking, for example. And some of them were sad ones. Although his hands were much stronger, and although it was less and less frequent, they still shook occasionally, and he knew Jude was embarrassed by it. And he was more skittish than ever about being touched, especially, Willem noticed, by Harold. A month ago, when Harold had visited, Jude had practically danced out of the way to keep Harold from hugging him. He had felt bad for Harold, seeing the expression on his face, and so had gone over and hugged him himself. "You know he can't help it," he told Harold quietly, and Harold had kissed him on the cheek. "You're a sweet man, Willem," he'd said. Now it was October, 13 months after the attempt. During the evening, he was at the theater. 2 months after his run ended in December, he'd start shooting his first project since he returned from Sri Lanka, an adaptation of Uncle Vanya that he was excited about and was being filmed in the Hudson Valley. He'd be able to come home every night. Not that the location was a coincidence. "Keep me in New York," he'd instructed his manager and his agent after he'd dropped out of the film in Russia the previous fall. "For how long?" asked Kit, his agent. "I don't know," he'd said. "At least the next year." "Willem," Kit had said, after a silence, "I understand how close you and Jude are, but don't you think you should take advantage of the momentum you have? You could do whatever you wanted." He was referring to the Iliad and the Odyssey, which had both been enormous successes, proof, Kit liked to point out, that he could do anything he wanted now. "From what I know of Jude, he'd say the same thing." And then, when he didn't say anything, "It's not like this is your wife or kid or something. This is your friend."
"You mean just your friend?" he'd said testily.
Kit was Kit. He thought like an agent, and he trusted how Kit thought. He had been with him since the beginning of his career. He tried not to fight with him, and Kit had always guided him well. No fat, no filler. He liked to brag about Willem's career, reviewing the history of his roles. They both knew that Kit was far more ambitious for him than he was. He always had been. And yet, it had been Kit who'd gotten him on the first flight out of Sri Lanka after Richard had called him. Kit who'd had the producers shut down production for 7 days so he could fly to New York and back. "I don't mean to offend you, Willem," Kit had said, carefully. "I know you love him. But come on. If he were the love of your life, I'd understand. But this seems extreme to me, to inhibit your career like this." And yet he sometimes wondered if he could ever love anyone as much as he loved Jude. It was the fact of him, of course, but also the utter comfort of life with him, of having someone who had known him for so long and who could be relied upon to always take him as exactly who he was on that particular day. His work, his very life, was one of disguises and charades. Everything about him and his context was constantly changing. His hair, his body, where he would sleep that night. He often felt he was made of something liquid, something that was being continually poured from bright-colored bottle to bright-colored bottle, with a little being lost or left behind with each transfer. But his friendship with Jude made him feel that there was something real and immutable about who he was, that despite his life of guises, there was something elemental about him, something that Jude saw even when he could not, as if Jude's very witness of him made him real. In graduate school, he'd had a teacher who had told him that the best actors are the most boring people. A strong sense of self was detrimental, because an actor had to let the self disappear. He had to let himself be subsumed by a character. "If you want to be a personality, be a pop star," his teacher had said. He had understood the wisdom of this, and still did, but really, the self was what they all craved, because the more you acted, the further and further you drifted from who you thought you were, and harder it was to find your way back. Was it any wonder that so many of his peers were such wrecks? They made their money, their lives, their identities by impersonating others. Was it a surprise, then, that they needed one set, one stage after the next, to give their lives shape? Without them, what and who were they? And so they took up religions and girlfriends and causes to give them something that could be their own. They never slept. They never stopped. They were terrified to be alone, to have to ask themselves who they were. When an actor talks and there's no one to hear him, is he still an actor? His friend Roman had once asked. He sometimes wondered. But to Jude, he wasn't an actor. He was his friend. And that identity supplanted everything else. It was a role he had inhabited for so long that it had become indelibly who he was. To Jude, he was no more primarily an actor than Jude was primarily a lawyer. It was never the first or second or third way that either of them would describe the other. It was Jude who remembered who he had been before he had made a life pretending to be other people. Someone with a brother. Someone with parents. Someone to whom everything and everyone seemed so impressive and beguiling. He knew other actors who didn't want anyone to remember them as they'd been, as someone so determined to be someone else, but he wasn't that person. He wanted to be reminded of who he was. He wanted to be around someone for whom his career would never be the most interesting thing about him. And if he was to be honest, he loved what came with Jude as well, Harold and Julia. Jude's adoption had been the first time he had ever felt envious of anything Jude had. He admired a lot of what Jude had, his intelligence and thoughtfulness and resourcefulness, but he had never been jealous of him. But watching Harold and Julia with him, watching how they watched him even when he wasn't looking at them, he had felt a kind of emptiness. He was parentless, and while most of the time he didn't think about this at all, he felt that, for as remote as his parents had been, they had at least been something that had anchored him to his life. Without any family, he was a scrap of paper floating through the air, being picked up and tossed aloft with every gust. He and Jude had been united in this. Of course, he knew this envy was ridiculous and beyond mean. He had grown up with parents, and Jude hadn't. He knew that Harold and Julia felt an affection for him as well, as much as he did for them. They had both seen every one of his films, and both sent him long and detailed reviews of them, always praising his performance and making intelligent comments about his co-stars and the cinematography. The only one they had never seen, or at least never commented on, was The Prince of Cinnamon, which was the film he had been shooting when Jude had tried to kill himself. He had never seen it himself. They read every article about him. Like his reviews, he avoided these articles, and bought a copy of every magazine that featured him. On his birthday, they would call and ask him what he was going to do to celebrate, and Harold would remind him of how old he was getting. At Christmas, they always sent him something, a book, along with a jokey little gift, or a clever toy that he would keep in his pocket to fiddle with as he talked on the phone or sat in the makeup chair. At Thanksgiving, he and Harold would sit in the living room watching the game, while Julia kept Jude company in the kitchen. "We're running low on chips," Harold would say. "I know," he'd say. "Why don't you go get more?" Harold would say. "You're the host," he'd remind Harold. "You're the guest." "Yeah, exactly." "Call Jude and get him to bring us more." "You call him." "No, you call him." "Fine," he'd say. "Jude! Harold wants more chips." "You're such a confabulator, Willem," Harold would say, as Jude came in to refill the bowl. Jude, this was completely Willem's idea. But mostly he knew that Harold and Julia loved him because he loved Jude. He knew they trusted him to take care of Jude. That was who he was to them, and he didn't mind it. He was proud of it. Lately, however, he had been feeling differently about Jude, and he wasn't sure what to do about it. They had been sitting on the sofa late one Friday night, he just home from the theater, Jude just home from the office, and talking about nothing in particular, when he had almost leaned over and kissed him. But he had stopped himself, and the moment had passed. But since then, he had been revisited by that impulse again. Twice, three times, four times. It was beginning to worry him. Not because Jude was a man. He'd had sex with men before. Everyone he knew had, and in college he and J.B. had drunkenly made out one night out of boredom and curiosity, an experience that had been, to their mutual relief, entirely unsatisfying. "It's really interesting how someone so good-looking can be such a turn-off," had been J.B.'s exact words to him. And not because he hadn't always felt the sort of low-key hum of attraction for Jude, the way he felt for more or less all of his friends. It was because he knew that if he tried anything, he would have to be certain about it, because he sensed, powerfully, that Jude, who was casual about nothing, certainly wouldn't be casual about sex. Jude's sex life, his sexuality, had been a subject of ongoing fascination for everyone who knew him, and certainly for Willem's girlfriends. Occasionally it had come up among the three of them, he and Malcolm and J.B., when Jude wasn't around. Was he having sex? Had he ever? With whom? They had all seen people looking at him at parties or flirting with him, and in every case, Jude had remained oblivious. "That girl was all over you," he'd say to Jude as they walked home from one party or another. "What girl?" Jude would say. They talked about it with one another because Jude had made it clear he wouldn't discuss it with any of them. When the topic was raised, he would give them one of his stares and then change the subject with a declarativeness that was impossible to misinterpret. "Has he ever spent the night away from home?" asked J.B. This was when he and Jude were living on Lispenard Street. "Guys," he'd say, the conversation made him uncomfortable, "I don't think we should be talking about this." "Willem," J.B. would say, "don't be such a pussy. You're not betraying any confidences. Just tell us. Yes or no. Has he ever?" He'd sigh. "No," he'd say. There would be a silence. "Maybe he's asexual," Malcolm would say, after a while. "No, that's you, Mal." "Fuck off, J.B. "Do you think he's a virgin?" J.B. would ask. "No," he'd say. He didn't know why he knew this, but he was certain he wasn't. "It's such a waste," J.B. would say, and he and Malcolm would look at each other, knowing what was coming next. "His looks have been wasted on him. I should have gotten his looks. I would have had a good time with him, at least." After a while, they grew to accept it as part of who Jude was. They added the subject to the list of things they knew not to discuss. Year after year passed, and he dated no one, and they saw him with no one. "Maybe he's living some hot double life," Richard once suggested, and Willem had shrugged. "Maybe," he said. But really, although he had no proof of this, he knew that Jude wasn't. It was in this same proofless way that he assumed Jude was probably gay, though maybe not, and probably hadn't ever had a relationship, though he really hoped he was wrong about this. And as much as Jude claimed otherwise, Willem wasn't ever convinced that he wasn't lonely, that he didn't, in some small, dark part of himself, want to be with someone. He remembered Lionel and Sinclair's wedding, where it had been Malcolm with Sophie and he with Robin and J.B., though they hadn't been speaking then, with Oliver, and Jude with no one. And although Jude hadn't seemed bothered by this, Willem had looked at him across the table and had felt sad for him. He didn't want Jude to get old alone. He wanted him to be with someone who would take care of him and be attracted to him. J.B. was right. It was a waste. And so was this what this was, this attraction? Was it fear and sympathy that had morphed itself into a more palatable shape? Was he convincing himself he was attracted to Jude because he couldn't stand to see him alone? He didn't think so. But he didn't know. The person he would have once discussed this with was J.B., but he couldn't speak to J.B. about this, even though they were friends again, or at least working toward friendship. After they had returned from Morocco, Jude had called J.B., and the two of them had gone out for dinner, and a month later, Willem and J.B. had gone out on their own. Oddly, though, he found it much more difficult to forgive J.B. than Jude had, and their first meeting had been a disaster. J.B. showily, exaggeratedly blithe, he seething, until they had left the restaurant and started yelling at each other. There they had stood on deserted Pell Street. It had been snowing, lightly, and no one else was out, accusing each other of condescension and cruelty, irrationality and self-absorption, self-righteousness and narcissism, martyrdom and cluelessness.
"You think anyone hates themselves as much as I do?"
JB had shouted at him. His fourth show, the one that documented his time on drugs and with Jackson, had been titled The Narcissist's Guide to Self-Hatred, and JB had referenced it several times during their dinner as proof that he had punished himself mightily and publicly and had now been reformed.
"Yeah, JB, I do," he'd shouted back at him. "I think Jude hates himself far more than you could ever hate yourself, and I think you knew that and you made him hate himself even more." "You think I don't know that?"
JB had yelled.
"You think I don't fucking hate myself for that?" "I don't think you hate yourself enough for it, no,"
he'd yelled back.
"Why did you do that, JB? Why did you do that to him, of all people?"
And then, to his surprise, JB had sunk, defeated, to the curb.
"Why didn't you ever love me the way you love him, Willem?"
he asked. He sighed.
"Oh, JB,"
he said, and sat down next to him on the chilled pavement.
"You never needed me as much as he did."
It wasn't the only reason, he knew, but it was part of it. No one else in his life needed him. People wanted him, for sex, for their projects, for his friendship even, but only Jude needed him. Only to Jude was he essential.
"You know, Willem," said JB, after a silence, "maybe he doesn't need you as much as you think he does."
He had thought about this for a while.
"No," he said finally, "I think he does."
Now JB sighed.
"Actually," he had said, "I think you're right."
After that, things had strangely improved. But as much as he was, cautiously, learning to enjoy JB again, he wasn't sure he was ready to discuss this particular topic with him. He wasn't sure he wanted to hear JB's jokes about how he had already fucked everything with two X chromosomes, and so now he was moving on to the Ys, or about his abandonment of heteronormative standards, or, worst of all, about how this attraction he thought he was feeling for Jude was really something else, a misplaced guilt for the suicide attempt, or a form of patronization, or simple misdirected boredom. So he did nothing and said nothing. As the months passed, he dated, casually, and he examined his feelings as he did. "This is crazy," he told himself. "This is not a good idea." Both were true. It would be so much easier if he didn't have these feelings at all. And so what if he did? He argued with himself. Everyone had feelings that they knew better than to act upon because they knew that doing so would make life so much more complicated. He had whole pages of dialogue with himself, imagining the lines, his and JB's, both spoken by him, typeset on white paper. But still the feelings persisted. They went to Cambridge for Thanksgiving, the first time in 2 years that they'd done so. He and Jude shared his room because Julia's brother was visiting from Oxford and had the upstairs bedroom. That night, he lay awake on the bedroom sofa, watching Jude sleep. How easy would it be, he thought, to simply climb into bed next to him and fall asleep himself? There was something about it that seemed almost preordained, and the absurdity was not in the fact of it, but in his resistance to the fact of it. They had taken the car to Cambridge, and Jude drove them home so he could sleep. "Willem," Jude said, as they were about to enter the city, "I want to ask you about something." He looked at him. "Are you okay? Is something on your mind?"
"Sure," he said. "I'm fine."
"You've seemed really pensive, I guess," Jude said. He was quiet. "You know, it's been a huge gift having you live with me. And not just live with me, but everything. I don't know what I would have done without you. But I know it must be draining for you. And I just want you to know,
If you want to move back home, I'll be fine. I promise. I'm not going to hurt myself. He had been staring at the road as he spoke, but now he turned to him. I don't know how I got so lucky, he said. He didn't know what to say for a while. Do you want me to move home? He asked. Jude was silent. Of course not, he said, very quietly. But I want you to be happy, and you haven't seemed very happy recently. He sighed. I'm sorry, he said. I've been distracted. You're right. But it's certainly not because I'm living with you. I love living with you. He tried to think of the right, the perfect next thing to add, but he couldn't. I'm sorry, he said again. Don't be, Jude said. But if you want to talk about any of it, ever, you always can. I know, he said. Thanks. They were quiet the rest of the way home. And then it was December. His run finished. They went to India on holiday, the four of them, the first trip they'd taken as a unit in years. In February, he began filming Uncle Vanya. The set was the kind he treasured and sought, but only rarely found. He had worked with everyone before, and they had all liked and respected one another, and the director was shaggy and mild and gentle, and the adaptation, which had been done by a novelist Jude admired, was beautiful and simple, and the dialogue was a pleasure to get to speak. When Willem was young, he had been in a play called The House on Thistle Lane, which had been about a family that was packing up and leaving a house in St. Louis that had been owned by the father's family for generations, but which they could no longer afford to maintain. But instead of a set, they had staged the play on one floor of a dilapidated brownstone in Harlem, and the audience had been allowed to wander between the rooms as long as they remained outside a roped-off area. Depending on where you stood to watch, you saw the actors and the space itself from different perspectives. He had played the eldest, most damaged son, and had spent most of the first act mute in the dining room, wrapping dishes in pieces of newspaper. He had developed a nervous tic for the son, who couldn't imagine leaving his childhood house, and as the character's parents fought in the living room, he would put down the plates and press himself into the far corner of the dining room near the kitchen and peel off the wallpaper in shreds. Although most of the act took place in the living room, there would always be a few audience members who would remain in his room, watching him scraping off the paper, a blue so dark it was almost black and printed with pale pink cabbage roses, and rolling it between his fingers and dropping it to the floor, so that every night one corner would become littered with little cigars of wallpaper, as if he were a mouse inexpertly building its tiny nest. It had been an exhausting play, but he had loved it. The intimacy of the audience, the unlikeliness of the stage, the small, detailed physicality of the role. This production felt very much like that play. The house, a Gilded Age mansion on the Hudson, was grand, but creaky and shabby, the kind of house his ex-girlfriend Philippa had once imagined they'd live in when they were married and ancient, and the director used only three rooms, the dining room, the living room, and the sun porch. Instead of an audience, they had the crew, who followed them as they moved through the space. But although he relished the work, part of him also recognized that Uncle Vanya was not exactly the most helpful thing he could be doing at the moment. On set, he was Dr. Astroff, but once he was back at Green Street, he was Sonia. And Sonia, as much as he loved the play and always had, as much as he loved and pitied poor Sonia herself, was not a role he had ever thought he might perform, under any circumstance. When he had told the others about the film, J.B. had said, "So it's a gender-blind cast, then?" And he'd said, "What do you mean?" And J.B. had said, "Well, you're obviously Elena, right?" And everyone had laughed, especially him. This was what he loved about J.B., he had thought. He was always smarter than even he knew. "He's far too old to play Elena," Jude had added, affectionately, and everyone had laughed again. Vanya was an efficient shoot, just 36 days,
and was over by the last week in March. One day, shortly after it had ended, he met an old friend and former girlfriend of his, Cressy, for lunch in Tribeca, and as he walked back to Green Street in the light, dry snow, he was reminded of how much he enjoyed the city in the late winter, when the weather was suspended between one season and the next, and when Jude cooked every weekend, and when you could walk the streets for hours and never see anyone but a few lone people taking their dogs out for a stroll. He was heading north on Church Street and had just crossed Reed when he glanced into a cafe on his right and saw Andy sitting at a table in the corner, reading. "Willem," said Andy as he approached him. "What are you doing here?"
"I just had lunch with a friend and I'm walking home," he said.
"What are you doing here?"
"You're so far downtown."
"You two and your walks," Andy said, shaking his head.
"George is at a birthday party a few blocks from here, and I'm waiting until I have to go pick him up."
"How old is George now?"
9.
"God, already?"
"I know."
"Do you want some company?" he asked. "Or do you want to be alone?"
"No," said Andy. He tucked a napkin into his book to mark his place.
"Stay, please."
And so he sat.
They talked for a while of course, Jude, who was on a business trip in Mumbai, and Uncle Vanya.
"I just remember Astroff as being an unbelievable tool," Andy said.
And his next project, which began shooting in Brooklyn at the end of April, and Andy's wife, Jane, who was expanding her practice, and their children. George, who had just been diagnosed with asthma, and Beatrice, who wanted to go to boarding school the following year. And then, before he could stop himself, not that he felt any particular need to try, he was telling Andy about his feelings for Jude, and how he wasn't sure what they meant or what to do about them. He talked and talked, and Andy listened, his face expressionless. There was no one else in the cafe but the two of them, and outside the snow fell faster and thicker, and he felt, despite his anxiety, deeply calm, and glad he was telling somebody, and that that somebody was a person who knew him and Jude both, and had for many years.
"I know this seems strange," he said, "and I've thought about what it could be, Andy. I really have. But part of me wonders if it was always meant to be this way. I mean, I've dated and dated for decades now, and maybe the reason it's never worked out is because it was never meant to, because I was supposed to be with him all along. Or maybe I'm telling myself this, or maybe it's simple curiosity. But I don't think it is. I think I know myself better than that." He sighed.
"What do you think I should do?"
Andy was quiet for a while.
"First," he said, "I don't think it's strange, Willem. I think it makes sense in a lot of ways. You two have always had something different, something unusual. So, I always wondered, despite your girlfriends. Selfishly, I think it'd be wonderful. For you, but especially for him. I think if you wanted to be in a relationship with him, it'd be the greatest, most restorative gift he could ever get. But Willem, if you do this, you should go in prepared to make some sort of commitment to him, and to being with him, because you're right. You're not going to be able to just fool around and then get out of it. And I think you should know that it's going to be very, very hard. You're going to have to get him to trust you all over again, and to see you in a different way. I don't think I'm betraying anything when I say that it's going to be very tough for him to be intimate with you, and you're going to have to be really patient with him."
They were both silent.
"So if I do it, I should do so thinking it's going to be forever," he told Andy, and Andy looked at him for a few seconds and then smiled.
"Well," Andy said, "there are worse life sentences."
"True," he said. He went back to Green Street. April arrived, and Jude returned home. They celebrated Jude's birthday.
43, Harold sighed. "I vaguely remember 43.
And he began shooting his next project. An old friend of his, a woman he'd known since graduate school, was starring in the production as well. He was playing a corrupt detective, and she was playing his wife, and they slept together a few times. Everything marched along as it always had. He worked. He came home to Green Street. He thought about what Andy had said. And then one Saturday morning he woke very early, just as the sky was brightening. It was late May, and the weather was unpredictable. Some days it felt like March, other days like July. 90 feet away from him lay Jude. And suddenly his timidity, his confusion, his dithering seemed silly. He was home, and home was Jude. He loved him. He was meant to be with him. He would never hurt him. He trusted himself with that much. And so what was there to fear? He remembered a conversation he'd had with Robin when he had been preparing to shoot the Odyssey and was rereading it and the Iliad, neither of which he had looked at since he was a freshman in college. This was when they had first begun dating and were both still trying to impress each other, when a sort of giddiness was derived from deferring to the other's expertise. "What are the most overrated lines from the poem?" he'd asked, and Robin had rolled her eyes and recited, "We still have not reached the end of our trials. One more labor lies in store, boundless, laden with danger, great and long, and I must brave it out from start to finish." She made some retching noises. "So obvious. And somehow that's been co-opted by every losing football team in the country as their pre-game rallying cry," she added, and he laughed. She looked at him slyly. "You played football," she said. "I bet those are your favorite lines as well." "Absolutely not," he'd said, in mock outrage. This was part of their game that wasn't always a game. He was the dumb actor, the dumber jock, and she was the smart girl who went out with him and taught him what he didn't know. "Then tell me what they are," she'd challenged him, and after he did, she'd looked at him intently. "Hmm," she said. "Interesting." Now he got out of bed and wrapped his blanket around himself, yawning. That evening he'd talked to Jude. He didn't know where he was going, but he knew he would be safe. He would keep them both safe. He went to the kitchen to make himself coffee, and as he did, he whispered the lines back to himself. Those lines he thought of whenever he was coming home, coming back to Green Street after a long time away. "And tell me this. I must be absolutely sure. This place I've reached, is it truly Ithaca?" As all around him, the apartment filled with light. Every morning he gets up and swims 2 miles, and then comes back upstairs and sits down and has breakfast and reads the papers. His friends make fun of him for this, for the fact that he actually prepares a meal instead of buying something on the way to work, for the fact that he actually still gets the papers delivered in paper form. But the ritual of it has always calmed him. Even in the home, it was the one time when the counselors were too mild, the other boys too sleepy to bother him. He would sit in the corner of the dining area and read and eat his breakfast, and for those minutes he would be left alone. He is an efficient reader, and he skims first through the Wall Street Journal and then the Financial Times before beginning with the New York Times, which he reads front to back when he sees the headline in obituaries, "Caleb Porter, 52, fashion executive." Immediately his mouthful of scrambled eggs and spinach turns to cardboard and glue, and he swallows hard, feeling sick, feeling every nerve ending thrumming alive. He has to read the article 3 times before he can make sense of any of the facts. Pancreatic cancer. "Very fast," said his colleague and longtime friend. Under his stewardship, emerging fashion label Rothko saw aggressive expansion into the Asian and Middle Eastern markets, as well as the opening of their first New York City boutique. Died at his home in Manhattan. Survived by his sister, Michaela Porter De Soto of Monte Carlo, 6 nieces and nephews, and his partner, Nicholas Lane, also a fashion executive. He is still for a moment, staring at the page until the words rearrange themselves into an abstraction of gray before his eyes, and then he hobbles as fast as he can to the bathroom near the kitchen, where he vomits up everything he's just eaten, gagging over the toilet until he's coughing up long strands of saliva. He lowers the toilet seat and sits, resting his face in his hands until he feels better. He wishes desperately for his razors, but he has always been careful not to cut himself during the day, partly because it feels wrong and partly because he knows he has to impose limits upon himself, however artificial, or he'd be cutting himself all day. Lately, he has been trying very hard not to cut himself at all. But tonight, he thinks, he will grant himself an exception. It is 7 a.m. In around 15 hours, he'll be home again. All he has to do is make it through the day. He puts his plate in the dishwasher and walks quietly through the bedroom and into the bathroom, where he showers and shaves and then gets dressed in the closet, first making sure that the door between the closet and the bedroom is completely closed. At this point, he has added a new step to his morning routine. Now, if he were to do what he has been for the past month, he would open the door and walk over to the bed, where he'd perch on its left side and put his hand on Willem's arm, and Willem would open his eyes and smile at him. "I'm off," he'd say, smiling back, and Willem would shake his head. "Don't go," Willem would say, and he'd say, "I have to," and Willem would say, 5 minutes, and he'd say, 5, and then Willem would lift his end of the blanket, and he'd crawl beneath it, with Willem pressed against his back, and he would close his eyes and wait for Willem to wrap his arms around him and wish he could stay forever. And then, 10 or 15 minutes later, he would at last, reluctantly, get up and kiss Willem somewhere near, but not on, his mouth. He is still having trouble with this, even 4 months later, and leave for the day. This morning, however, he skips this step. He instead pauses at the dining room table to write Willem a note, explaining that he had to leave early and didn't want to wake him. And then, as he's walking to the door, he comes back and grabs the Times off the table and takes it with him. He knows how irrational it is, but he doesn't want Willem to see Caleb's name, or picture, or any evidence of him. Willem still doesn't know about what Caleb did to him, and he doesn't want him to. He doesn't even want him to be aware of Caleb's very existence, or, he realizes, his once existence, for Caleb no longer exists. Beneath his arm, the paper feels almost alive with heat. Caleb's name, a dark knot of poison cradled inside its pages. He decides to drive to work, so he'll be able to be alone for a little while. But before he leaves the garage, he takes out the paper and reads the article one more time before folding it up again and shoving it into his briefcase. And then suddenly, he is crying, frantic, breathy sobs, the kind that come from his diaphragm. And as he leans his head on the steering wheel, trying to regain control, he is finally able to admit to himself how plainly, profoundly relieved he is, and how frightened he has been for the past 3 years, and how humiliated and ashamed he is still. He retrieves the paper, hating himself, and reads the obituary again, stopping at, "and by his partner, Nicholas Lane, also a fashion executive." He wonders, did Caleb do to Nicholas Lane what he did to him? Or is Nicholas, as he must be, someone undeserving of such treatment? He hopes that Nicholas never experienced what he had, but he's also certain he hasn't, and the knowledge of that makes him cry harder. That had been one of Harold's arguments when he was trying to get him to report the attack, that Caleb was dangerous, and that by reporting him, by having him arrested, he would be protecting other people from him. But he had known that wasn't true. Caleb wouldn't do to other people what he did to him. He hadn't hit and hated him because he hit and hated other people. He had hit and hated him because of who he was, not because of who Caleb was. Finally, he's able to compose himself, and he wipes his eyes and blows his nose. The crying, another leftover from his time with Caleb. For years and years, he was able to control it. And now, Ever since that night, it seems he is always crying, or on the verge of it, or actively trying to stop himself from doing it. It's as if all his progress from the past few decades has been erased, and he is again that boy in Brother Luke's care, so teary and helpless and vulnerable. He's about to start the car when his hands begin shaking. Now he knows he can do nothing but wait, and he folds them in his lap and tries to make his breaths deep and regular, which sometimes helps. By the time his phone rings a few minutes later, they've slowed somewhat, and he hopes he sounds normal as he answers. "Hi, Harold," he says. "Jude," says Harold. His voice is flattened somehow. "Have you read the Times today?" Immediately, the shaking intensifies. "Yes," he says. "Pancreatic cancer is a terrible way to go," says Harold. He sounds grimly satisfied. "Good. I'm glad." There's a pause. "Are you all right?" "Yes," he says. "Yes, I'm fine." "The connection keeps cutting out," says Harold. But he knows it's not. It's because he's shaking so badly that he can't hold the phone steady. "Sorry," he says. "I'm in the garage. Look, Harold, I'd better get up to work. Thanks for calling."
"Okay," Harold sighs. "You'll call me if you want to talk, right?"
"Yes," he says. "Thanks." It's a busy day, for which he's grateful, and he tries to give himself no time to think about anything but work. Late in the morning, he gets a text from Andy. "Assume you've seen that the asshole is dead. Pancreatic cancer equals major suffering. You okay?" And writes back to assure him he's fine, and over lunch he reads the obituary one last time before stuffing the entire paper into the shredder and turning back to his computer. In the afternoon, he gets a text from Willem saying that the director he's meeting with about his next project has pushed back their dinner, so he doesn't think he'll be home before 11, and he is relieved. At 9, he tells his associates he's leaving early, and then drives home and goes directly to the bathroom, shucking his jacket and rolling up his sleeves and unstrapping his watch as he goes. He's almost hyperventilating with desire by the time he makes the first cut. It has been nearly 2 months since he's made more than 2 cuts in a single sitting. But now he abandons his self-discipline and cuts and cuts and cuts until finally his breathing slows and he feels the old, comforting emptiness settle inside him. After he's done, he cleans up and washes his face and goes to the kitchen, where he reheats some soup he'd made the weekend before and has his first real meal of the day, and then brushes his teeth and collapses into bed. He is weak from the cutting, but he knows if he rests for a few minutes, he'll be fine. The goal is to be normal by the time Willem comes home, to not give him anything to worry about, to not do anything else to upset this impossible and delirious dream he's been living in for the past 18 weeks. When Willem had told him of his feelings, he had been so discomforted, so disbelieving, that it was only the fact that it was Willem saying it that convinced him it wasn't some terrible joke. His faith in Willem was more powerful than the absurdity of what Willem was suggesting. But only barely.
"What are you saying?" he asked Willem for the 10th time. "I'm saying I'm attracted to you," Willem said, patiently. And then, when he didn't say anything, "Judy, I don't think it's all that odd, really. Haven't you ever felt that way about me in all these years?"
"No," he said instantly, and Willem had laughed. But he hadn't been joking. He would never, ever have been so presumptuous as to even picture himself with Willem. Besides, he wasn't what he had ever imagined for Willem. He had imagined someone beautiful and female and intelligent for Willem, someone who would know how fortunate she was, someone who would make him feel fortunate as well. He knew this was, like so many of his imaginings about adult relationships, somewhat gauzy and naive, but that didn't mean it couldn't happen. He was certainly not the kind of person Willem should be with. For Willem to be with him over the theoretical fantasy woman he'd conjured for him was an unbelievable tumble. The next day, he presented Willem with a list of 20 reasons why